So, in order to talk about the topic this evening, which, as you see on the sheet, is the Jewish identity, because that's been our theme all year, and the Israel-diaspora relationship, I wanted to go back for a minute to something we actually discussed in the beginning of the year, and that was the case of Brother Daniel. Right? So, when we talked about that case, and just to refresh our memories, that was the fellow who had grown up in Poland pre-war and was very Zionist, was part of the Akiva Zionist youth group and so on. During the war, he hid and pretended to be a Christian, ultimately ended up in a monastery, and then after the war converted to Catholicism and became a Carmelite monk, and then wanted to make Aliyah post-war to Israel under the right of return. And the question was, is he entitled to return under the right of return if now he is a Catholic? So as part of our discussion, and I think really the central piece of the discussion, we asked the question of whether Judaism is an ethnicity conveyed by biology, you're part of this family that has descended over time, or whether Judaism is an ideology. It's about what you believe in, right? If it's an ethnicity, if it's biology, so he's as Jewish as anybody else. If it's about belief, in order to become a Catholic, he has to renounce the beliefs of Judaism. So we talked about it as sort of this polarity where either it's biology or it's ideology, and then as we explained at the time, we said that you could actually look at it as both. That there are really these dual elements. There is, in fact, the idea of I'm part of a nation, I'm responsible to the nation, and that's one piece of it. And then the other piece of it is the beliefs of Judaism. And we talked about Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein's point that when somebody converts to Judaism, they actually are supposed to accept both. Both pieces are considered significant. But what I want to do tonight is to talk about the fact that for much of Jewish history, there's actually been a third way to look at Jewish identity. And at first it's counterintuitive, but the more you look at it, or the more I look at it at any rate, the more sense it makes. And it's something that can be quite controversial. And that is the possibility that Judaism is a state. A state, meaning like a country. You know, a unit that is sovereign over a particular piece of territory, a particular geographic area, and those who live together in the state are the Jews. That would be this third way to look at it. If someone's not living in the state, then they're not Jewish.
You mean state or the state of Israel?
I mean state like country. Yeah. As in, all of us living here in Toronto would not have full status as Jews. It sounds a little bit bizarre, no?
Yes.
At first. But you'll see what I mean. And you could consider this sort of an uber-Zionist definition of what it means to be Jewish. A Jew is somebody who longs for a state when there is none, and then when there is one, packs his bags and says, okay, that's where I'm going to be. It would have very interesting ramifications, right? It could mean, theoretically, that an Arab Israeli would be more Jewish than a biological, ideological Jew who supports the state of Israel, but you know, lives in Canada. Now, you know, most of us, I think, living outside of Israel, don't really ask the question of whether Judaism is a state, whether you have to live in Israel to be Jewish. It's obvious to us that our identity as Jews is not defined by geographic boundaries. But there is logic to the idea that living in the state makes us part of the family of Jews, and if you're not living there, you're not part of the family of Jews. Try to defend it. You know, see it from the other side. What would be the logic in saying that you have to live in Israel in order to have the identity of a Jew?
Well, to serve in the armed forces. We don't serve in the armed forces.
Right.
So we're not part of that part.
Right. To which Harvey responds, not all of them do either. but yes.
Yeah, but you have the situation where so many of them are so secularized. Mm-hmm. And if anything, they do things in spite of. So then, does that make them better than we who might be not particularly that observant, but more aware of the customs of things and the religion?
Well, that would be precisely the question. Right, that would be precisely the question. But I would take the army service point further. It's not just about army service. It's about living the threats and living the sacrifices that are involved in being in the state of Israel, meaning the fact that when they pay taxes, they're paying taxes to the government of the Jewish state. The fact that when there's a threat from Lebanon, or when there's a threat from, you know, fill in the blank, whichever country you want, they're the ones who are going into the bomb shelters. Right? There's a sense of being part of family in that they endure the same threats and risks. Yes?
But there's a difference between an Israeli and a Jew.
Mm. So that would be the question.
No. An Israeli and a Jew?
Yes. The Arabs, Muslims are Israelis.
They're Israeli.
That would be the question. I'll push the question further. Living in Israel connects us to our national history, right? In terms of our ancestors who lived in that land, right? Abram and Sarah, who make the trek from the east to come live in that land, to walk where they walked, to live where they live, as opposed to, you know, being here, a very nice country, you know, I can be where John McDonald, you know, lived. It's an entirely different identity. It connects us to our philosophical history, being there. Yeah.
Well, the whole flow of life in Israel, too, is the holidays, the way the days are numbered, everything. But I don't know if this applies, but this winter I met a Sadmar Chuset. I spent quite a bit of time with him.
Okay.
And he would attack this vigorously because he said, what has kept people Jewish is the Torah, not the state of Israel. It's Torah observance that keeps us going, and we're building, I don't agree with him completely, believe me, but spending too much time talking about Israel, supporting Israel at the risk of letting Torah study slip, is why the Sefer are not happy with the state of Israel. Now, this is a young guy. I don't know if that's true, Seth, but this is his idea.
Right. I mean, that's one reason they're not happy. There are a few reasons they're not happy. It's not only about that. But I agree that he wouldn't like this this standard. Yes, Bernie.
So it's an interesting thesis that you're putting forward. Then it would mean that my parents, my grandparents, my great-grandparents were never Jewish because they never lived in the state of Israel.
And that's why I presented it with the note that when there is no state, to long for the state, and then when there is one, to pick up and go.
Is there any other type of situation where that would be true? Like saying that a person is an American, even if they're not living in the States, or when they're living in the States, then they're American, but if they move to another country, they're no longer American.
Well, I'll tell you, the debate goes on all the time about voting rights, right? If you don't live in Canada, but you're a Canadian citizen, do you have the right to vote? That's right. Been controversial over the years.
Is it the right for the Americans?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Americans have the ability to vote in the U.S. despite not living
there.
They
pay taxes even if they don't.
So do citizens of other countries that don't live in the country have the right to vote. So you're presenting something that is kind of one of a kind. It has only happened to Jews. So Jews are blessed with another...
I mean, that idea doesn't bother me. We are one of a kind in so many different ways. But I'll show you where I'm going with this. And I think you'll see you'll see it. But I think just to flesh out the idea further and give it a little bit more heft, living in the state involves proximity to Jerusalem, to the temple site, if not the temple itself anymore. living in the state involves the opportunity for performing various mitzvot, fulfilling laws that can only be fulfilled in Israel. A couple of years ago, we talked about Shemitah, the sabbatical year, and leaving the land fallow. It's become popular every 7 years now. You see articles about how people should accept this practice beyond the land of Israel, and it should be a sabbatical year. And that's all well and good, but the law itself is land specific. But what we're going to see is that this has actually been a live question for Jews for a very, very long time. It goes back to biblical times. This question of, are you a Jew if you choose to live outside of the state? And again, I'm not talking about when there is no state, but when there is one and you have the option to be there. Yeah.
Realistically, the question is kind of new because it's symbiotic. We have a function in diaspora and in supporting Israel, protecting it in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I know years ago the Israelis were much more smug about if you didn't come and, you know, go to the army and so on. They're not talking the same tune anymore. And they're much more aware of the fact that Jews in diaspora are supportive and not only give money, but they do a lot of other positive things to protect and support Israel.
I think that some may be more pragmatic in their perspective.
Yeah.
But I know some who are not. I've had some tell me forthrightly, that if you're not living here, you're not in. I mean, I'm going to show you. Take a look. Jump down to source number 11. Rabbi Jeremy Gimpel was the speaker at the Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaAtzmaut program at the Bayit last year. Great speaker, really electric, powerful young guy. And he showed, in the beginning, he showed a video, which was his video, called What Does It Mean to Be a Zionist Today? And this is a quote from the video. When it comes to loving Israel, there are two types of people in the world. Those that are pro-Israel and those that are Zionist. Rooting for and defending what you love is wonderful. But a Zionist is something totally different. He made the comparison in his video to being the fan of a sports team, watching from the sidelines, as opposed to being on the team. I, along with many other people, thought that it was an immature perspective, that it reflected a lack of sophistication. But there are people who really believe this. And their perspective, in fact, is if you're in the land, then you're in. If you're not in the land, you're not. But I'm not even talking about someone who's coming from that kind of a perspective. Let me show you where this is going, and you'll see, I think, why this has been a question. It goes all the way back to the first time there was a diaspora. When is the first Jewish diaspora? Yeah. Before Babylon.
When they went to Egypt.
So when we went to Egypt, I wouldn't count it as a diaspora only because there was no state. We didn't leave anybody behind. In order for there to be a diaspora, the way I'm conceiving of it, which is maybe not a full definition, maybe I need to refine my terms, but the idea that there are Jews who are living in the land and there are Jews who are living outside of the land by choice. The first time that occurred. When the tribes separated. The Jews come out of Egypt. They spend their 40 years in the wilderness because of the sin of the spies. And then finally they're on the cusp of entering the land. Up step the tribes of Reuven and Gad. And their spokespeople approach Moses and say to him, actually, we're not interested in crossing the Jordan at all. Remember that when the Jews were going to enter the land, they came up from the south. So they are east of the Jordan. They're south. They approach the land controlled by Edom. Edom are descendants of Esau, brother of Jacob, and the Jews are not supposed to fight a war against them. They send a message to Edom saying, would you please let us cross through? We'd like to come into the land. Edom says, no way. And the Jews go around. They then encounter Moab. There's a whole incident involving Bilam, who wants to curse the Jews. They go around Moab. They don't pick a fight with Moab. The next nation they encounter is the Amorites. Unlike Moab, they aren't family of ours. Unlike Edom, they aren't family of ours. We send a message to the Amorites, led by a king named Sichon, and say to him, let us go through into the land. Our quarrel is not with you. And they say, no way, and they come out to war with us. We fight back, we conquer the land of the Amorites, which is a nice big chunk of land in what is today Jordan. Well, that's where we pick up here in source number one. From Numbers chapter 32. And great cattle belonged to the tribes of Reuben and Gad, a mighty amount. And they saw the land of Yazer and Gilad, and the place was a place of cattle. And the tribes of Reuben and Gad came and spoke to Moses and to Eleazar the high priest and to the tribal leaders, saying, and I skipped it. They list all the cities that they see there that they can now live in. And they say, if we have found favor in your eyes, let this land be given to your servants as a portion. Do not take us across the Jordan. They don't want to go. Well, you remember this? If you remember this story, do you remember how Moses responds? How do you think he's going to respond?
He didn't bring them all this way for them to stay on this side.
Yeah. What do you mean you want to live outside of the land, east of the Jordan? First of all, who asked you your opinion? This hasn't been an opt-in thing. We'd rather not cross the Jordan. We're actually going to stay here. We like the view. There's a beautiful view here. You can see everything. So take a look at source number two, which brings you two verses out of the response that Moses gives them. Moses is not, it's very interesting. In the very beginning of his career, Moses is approached by God to lead the Jews. And what's his response? I'm not a man of words. As he goes along, his speeches get longer and longer. So here he says, this is just pulled from his speech. Moses said to the tribes of Reuben and Gad, shall your brothers go to war while you settle here? Right? Everybody else is going to have to go fight for the land, and you just get to hang out on the eastern side of the Jordan? And behold, you have risen in the place of your ancestors a crop of sinners to add further to divine rage upon Israel. First sentence first. That one is clear. You're going to stay outside the land? You're not going to invest the way we invest? You're not going to sacrifice the way we sacrifice? How dare you? Right? You're supposed to be with us. That's number one. But number two is a religious point. When he speaks of their ancestors, and he says, you have risen in the place of your ancestors, a crop of sinners, what he means is, their ancestors are the ones who said, as the spies, we can't go into the land, we don't want to go into the land, it's a dangerous place, we can't conquer them, the land eats its inhabitants. He says, that's what you're like. That's what you resemble at this point, he says. So the objection that Moses gives is twofold. Number one, in terms of sacrifice, are you part of us or are you not part of us? And number two, in terms of religion, you're not committed to God's gift, as we are. Now, how does this story end? This story of these tribes who don't want to settle in the land. What happens?
They settle outside.
They settle outside, but what are the terms of the deal? What are the terms of the deal that allow them to settle outside the land? They have to send soldiers in to fight with everybody else. So the terms of the deal are that they set up shop, they build small towns on the eastern side of the Jordan, and they leave most of their families there, but they send their elite troops across the river, across the Jordan, and they actually do more than Moses asks of them. Moses says, I want you to fight with us. They say, we're going to lead the charge. We're going to fight ahead of everybody else. So that's how this gets resolved, by them saying, we are going to make the sacrifices that everybody else is making. We are going to fight for the land. But that's the first time that you have a diaspora, and they're saying, who are you to be in a diaspora? By what right do you not face what we face? By what right do you abandon the portion that God has assigned for the Jewish people? But it doesn't stop there. That's the first time. When I asked before, so when is the first diaspora? It was Diane who said Babylon?
No, it was Claire.
Claire. Okay, Claire said you moved. That's the problem. I knew it was that direction. The second time around is, in fact, in Babylon. Not initially in Babylon, because, again, they've been kicked out of the land, right? The Babylonians, first the Assyrians came, and they exiled the northern kingdom. And then the Babylonians came, and they destroyed the temple and exiled the southern kingdom. But then the Babylonians are defeated by the Persians and the Medes. Cyrus the Great, also known as Cyrus the Second, allows the Jews to come back and build the second temple. And how many Jews go?
Not all of them.
42,360. That's the census that we get in the book of Ezra. 42,360 are in the initial wave of Jews who return from Babylon. Far fewer than the greater population of Jews that remains behind. They say, that sounds like a really nice experiment. Send us a letter. You know, let us know how that goes. They support them. They give financial support. Cyrus decrees it. Cyrus says, anybody who's not going had better pay up. Cyrus is a very interesting king. There's a lot to be said about Cyrus. But while they send their donations, they give to the UJA campaign, they don't actually make the trip. And in that first generation that doesn't go, in the book of Zechariah in chapter 5, the prophet Zechariah predicts punishment for the Jews who remain in Babylon. They're sinning by remaining in the diaspora. And in the next generation, Ezra, leader of the Jews of that time, sees that the Levites have not returned in real numbers, and he punishes them. He says there's a tithe that the Levites are entitled to, now they're not getting it. They're not going to get the tithe because they haven't come back in real numbers. So you see biblically this sense of, if you're a Jew, this is where you're supposed to be. If you're not coming back, then you're not making the sacrifices everybody else is making, and you're not playing the religious role that everybody else is playing. I'm not supporting one side or the other in this question. I may be arguing a little bit stronger for this because I know that people need to be convinced that this is a question in the first place. But that's where this question begins. But it's not where this question ends. It continues in Jewish history. You move forward to the Roman period and the period of the Talmud. And here you find this stance that says, if you're not in the land, your Jewish identity is lacking in a very serious way. Take a look, please, at source number 3. A passage in the Talmud. One should always live in the land of Israel, even in a city which is mostly of idolaters, rather than live outside of the land of Israel, even in a city which is mostly of Jews. Okay, so if I have my choice between living in Ramallah, or maybe safety issues, but if I have my choice between living in Ramallah on the one hand, or living in, you know, Bathurst Lawrence on the other, he's saying, you go to Ramallah. For anyone who lives in the land of Israel is as though he has a relationship with God. And anyone who lives outside of the land of Israel is as though he has no relationship with God. Where did you get that idea from? That's a very bold statement. It's a biblical verse. The text says, God says, I want to give you the land of Canaan to be your God. I'm your God when you're living in the land of Canaan. When I give you the land and you live there, that's when I'm going to be your God. There's another passage there where they quote a verse from King David. King David at one point has to flee, and he goes to the land of the Philistines. And he says, I have been sent away from the Shekhinah. I have been sent away from God. Now, the Talmud finds this statement a little bit too strong. It says, you have to temper that a little bit. They ask, still in number 3, but does anyone who does not live in the land of Israel have no relationship with God? Is that really true? You don't live in the land, you have no relationship? Can't be. Rather, it means to teach, anyone who lives outside of the land of Israel is as though he worships idols. Not so bad.
You're crossing your lines here, though.
Yes.
We began by saying that the definition of a Jew has to do with, effectively, with residence. Mm-hmm. If you're in the state. Now you're saying it has to do with whether or not you believe in God.
Why?
What about a Jew, someone who lives in the state, who doesn't believe in God?
It sounds like here he still has a relationship.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like, right? We said better to live even in a city that's mostly idolatrous. It sounds, in fact, like it's saying that just by dint of living in the land, you already have something. This isn't the only source of
whether you want it or not.
Whether you want it or not. Correct. Correct. There are all sorts of passages.
A lot of secular Israelis today feel exactly like that.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Very much so.
Have I heard that, like that, people have said, just by living in Israel, you have performed all the mitzvot. It's as if you had performed all the mitzvot.
So I don't know if that it's as if you performed all of the mitzvot, but there is, in this same section in the Talmud, there's a passage saying that by walking 4 cubits in Israel, you have automatically earned a share of reward in the next world, that being in Israel atones for one's sins, grows your hair back. No, the idea does, the idea is very strong that there is a Jewish identity that comes about by residing in the land purely by living there. That's where you live, that's good enough.
What's the definition of diaspora?
I don't know. That's a good question. Anybody know the etymology of the word diaspora? I'll have to look that up and email it afterwards in the follow-up.
Google.
It's a good question. I don't know. Yes. It sounds Greek, but I have no idea what it actually
means. And it isn't only Judaism that has, like Israel that has a diaspora. There are other...
Well, you can use it. You can use it for anyone. Is that because we had it and then it was borrowed? I don't know. I'll have to look it up. And when I send out the follow-up email with a link to the audio and all that, so God willing, I'll include a diaspora idea, a diaspora lesson. If you take a look at source number 4, it's a similar idea. This is a very old midrash, which describes, it's commenting on a biblical verse, which is part of the Shema, which says, you will quickly be lost if you sin. You will quickly be lost. Dot, dot, dot. You'll be kicked out of the land. And you shall place these words. It's the passage that then continues to say, you shall place these words on your arm and on your head. Talking about the tefillin, as well as on your doorpost, the mezuzah. But what the Midrash does is it says, you'll quickly be lost from the land. And you shall do these mitzvot. You shall fulfill these commandments. Even though I exile you from the land, be marked by your mitzvot, so that when you return, they will not be new for you.
That's implying that you're going to continue doing those mitzvot when you're living in the land.
Well, that's true. It implies that you're going to come back and that you're going to continue the mitzvot. What else does it imply, though, about the value of mitzvot outside of the land?
It's just a practice.
Practice! I don't know if you have Allen Iverson fans here. No. Okay. It's a long story, but he was a basketball player who did not think much of questions about his conduct in practice. But that's what it is. He's saying it's practice. Why am I doing all these mitzvot outside of the land? So that when I come back, they won't be new for me.
How
how well defined were boundaries? Because it seems to me that if you have a house on this side of the boundary, as opposed to on the other side of the street, which is outside of the boundary, you know, you're completely different animals here.
Yes.
So how well defined were the boundaries?
The boundaries are actually relatively well defined. And the reason I say relatively is because one point that I didn't get into before is what becomes of this land east of the Jordan? Meaning, initially when we approach the land, we are given clear boundaries. The eastern boundary of Israel is the Jordan River. The western boundary is the Mediterranean. North, it's from this point to this point to this point. The southern boundary, we get certain points which become difficult to analyze in later days because we've lost our knowledge of some of the landmarks that are mentioned. But there are several landmarks that are given at the end of the book of Numbers. The only part that's vague is that actually once they cut this deal for the tribes to remain east of the Jordan, that land actually becomes part of Israel for certain purposes. So they are a diaspora to begin with, and they stop being a diaspora. They're annexed, if you will, to the land. But the boundaries are fairly straightforward. The only piece that remains vague is the status east of the Jordan, in particular because whereas the western boundary is very clear, Mediterranean Sea, eastern boundary, former eastern boundary of the Jordan is very clear as well. When you get to the lands that are east of the Jordan and you push your way east, they end in desert. And so there isn't a clearly defined end to the end of the land that these tribes adopt that we think of as Jordan. There isn't a clear end. It's just sort of, well, no one lives there because it's desert. So there actually is some challenge in terms of defining a boundary for that area.
But there's a clear assumption that you will come back. That's if you come back.
Correct.
When you come back.
Correct. So what you see here is the idea of closeness to God being Israel specific. And by the way, that's not unique to us. Meaning in the ancient Near East, long before Roman times, going back to biblical times, you had this idea that a tribe had its god, and its god was powerful in its own land. Right? Pharaoh believes whatever god this is of the Hebrews, he's out of his jurisdiction. He has no authority here in Egypt. There was an idea that a god is land-specific, and so it would make sense. You want to have a relationship with God. That's going to be specifically in Israel. So but what we're seeing here in this Talmud in number 3 and in this Midrash in number 4 is beyond that. It's putting it as a Jewish idea. Jews have never believed in God as being land specific. The idea of God is Meloch Kol HaOlam, the entire world is His. But let me go a little further with what they felt about living in Israel and Jewish identity. I love this line in source number 5. What is a tipesh in Aramaic?
A tipesh.
A fool. Right? A tipesh is a fool. It makes it into Hebrew, makes it into Yiddish. It's a term for somebody who is foolish. So in number 5, the Talmud uses the phrase Bavloi tipshai, foolish Babylonians. There was a certain debate going on. And they related an idea from the Babylonians to Rabbi Yirmiah. Rabbi Yirmiah lived in Israel. And he declared, "Foolish Babylonians, because you live in a dark land, you teach muddied ideas." The idea of Babylon being a dark land is because topographically it's a much lower land. You're talking about Iraq, basically when you're talking about Babylon. And whereas in Israel they were up in the mountains, in Babylon, they'd be in a much lower lying area. They think of it as a dark land. And he says, therefore, you teach muddied ideas. Your ideas are cloudy. Your knowledge of Torah must be deficient if you're living there. If you take a look at number 6, when Rabbi Zera moved to Israel, Rabbi Zera was very controversial because his Rebbe, his mentor, Rabbi Yehuda, believed, as the Satmar today believe, that you're not supposed to move back to Israel, you're supposed to wait for the Messiah to bring you home. Yeah. So that was what Rabbi Yehuda believed. He believed, based on biblical text, that you're not supposed to to go back. Sorry?
Is that why the Orthodox, a lot of all Orthodox don't go back?
So it's why it's why many pre-Holocaust going back to the 1870s, 1880s, when people started to come back, many of the Orthodox, in particular Hasidic, were anti-Zionist, was based on that concern.
Yeah.
That shifted over time to other ideas.
But for example, I'm in school, they don't believe in, a lot of them are...
They mark Yom HaAtzmaut. They invite me to speak every year. They do something. That could be, but they, as someone who has been invited there to speak on Yom HaAtzmaut for the last several years, I can tell you that that they do have something. It's a little bit afield, but what's going on there is a fundamental conflict between, on the one hand, wanting to recognize the hand of God that has restored us to the land from a religious perspective, and then on the other hand, not wanting to endorse a state that does things that they have such problems with. Whether you're talking about the issue of drafting men and women into the same units in the military, or whether you're talking about drafting yeshiva students, or whether you're talking about running buses on Shabbat and so forth, there are so many things that they feel like, well, if we endorse this, then we're endorsing that. And so they're trying to walk a line in between the two. But realistically, most of the Orthodox world today visits, goes, you know, buys land and pays taxes on it, and it's the Neturei Karta, the ones you see demonstrating at the Walk with Israel every year,
yeah,
are an entirely different creature. We talked about them a few years ago when one of my first sessions with the group was about them and what their philosophy is. But that's already further distant from what we're talking about here. So Rabbi Zeira's mentor, Rabbi Yehuda, says, you're not allowed to go to Israel. So what do you do when you want to do something, but your rabbi says no? What do? He says, find a new rabbi. You do it where he can't see you. That's what happened. Rabbi Zeira said, well, I'm going. And so what he did was he stopped going to the Beit Midrash. He stopped going to the study hall, lest Rabbi Yehuda tell him he can't go. And then in the end, he ran into him somewhere anyway, and they had this debate about going. Rabbi Zeira went. In the end, Rabbi Zeira went. So here, I shouldn't tell you this, I'm giving you all sorts of ideas, but source number 6, when Rabbi Zeira moved to Israel, he fasted 100 fasts to forget Babylonian teachings, lest they distract him. He fasted 100 fasts because he said, I want to forget what I learned in Babylon. I don't want it to distract me. I'm going to Israel. There I'm going to be a real Jew, and there I'm going to have real Torah, and I don't want to be distracted with what I had elsewhere.
Well, didn't he have Torah in Babylon?
So apparently it wasn't good enough. He says, I don't want that to distract me when I come to the land. Take a look at source number 7. This is a matter of Jewish law, the legitimacy of the land when Jews live there, versus the legitimacy of Jewish settlement outside of the land. There's a verse in Leviticus which says, you may be familiar with it, it appears on the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, and you shall proclaim liberty in the land for all of her inhabitants, right? It's the Jubilee year. Every 50 years, everybody goes free. So the verse says, for all of her inhabitants, when all of her inhabitants are there, not when some of them are in exile. Meaning it only applies, this mitzvah only applies when the Jews have come back to the land. So what you have is a very real contention. Going back to the first diaspora, whatever that word means, but going to the first diaspora of those two tribes, Reuben and Gad, and working its way forward in Jewish law, into the Talmud and into the Midrash in the Roman period, to say that Jewish life in Israel, that's where a Jew really has a Jewish identity, and outside, no relationship with God, inferior Torah knowledge, lack of legitimacy in the eyes of Jewish law, the mitzvot are just practice. However, it's not a one-sided debate. Because when have Jews ever had a one-sided debate? there's always a response. And there was certainly a backlash in terms of this questioning of the legitimacy of the Jews outside of Israel. There were Jews outside of Israel who questioned the legitimacy of Jewish settlement in the land.
Yeah.
It went both ways. And this begins already in biblical times, in the Second Temple period, the beginning of the Second Temple. I told you that Zechariah, the prophet Zechariah, when the Jews first come back to build the temple, he condemns the Jews who have not come back. Well, they sent a letter to him in chapter 7 of the book of Zechariah, source number 8, asking him, "Shall I," it's worded in the singular, "shall I cry in the fifth month, abstaining as I have done for these many years?" What are they talking about, crying in the fifth month? What's, the month of Av, right. The month of Av. Remember that the Jewish calendar starts from the month of Nisan, which is the month we're in right now.
Yeah.
Right? Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz. Av is the fifth month, the month of Tisha B'Av. The Jews living outside of Israel, the Jews who are living in Babylon, send a message to the prophet who's leading the Jews who have returned, who's building the temple, and say to him, "Tell me, should we keep fasting on Tisha B'Av?" In other words, you really think what you're doing is legitimate? You think that you have the Messiah now, and you can stop fasting, you've built the temple, and it's all fine? They challenge the legitimacy of what's going on in the land, and as the Talmud explains, they challenge it because this new temple doesn't have all the miracles of the old temple, doesn't have the grandeur of the old temple, the population is tiny, and so they say, "We're not so impressed by what you've built up there in the land. You tell me you're the center of Jewish identity. We're not so convinced." And when you move ahead to the Talmudic period, you find those who say, "You know what? We're not so impressed by the scholarship you have there either." Take a look at source number 9. In the Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan made Aliyah. He moved from Babylon to Israel. But he said, "You know, I used to think that wisdom was yours." Meaning, I used to think wisdom came from Israel. But I see it's actually theirs. Not actually, they're smarter in Babylon. That's where wisdom comes from. He says, "We have it, not you." Yeah.
They progressed so much in Babylon, and they came back to Israel, they were stagnant or static.
Well, that's hard to say. Meaning, the Jews in Israel wrote their own Talmud. It isn't as though they weren't developing either. I mean, the Mishnah was written in Israel, the core text of the Talmud. But this continues further in Jewish history. It doesn't stop here. In the 10th century, there's a great battle that goes on. It's worth taking a second to discuss this. The period of the Gaonim. After the Talmud is concluded in the 6th century Common Era. Then you have a few generations, some kind of redaction is going on, but what emerges in that period post-Talmudically is there are central academies that are based in Babylon. And the head of each academy is called a Gaon. Gaon in modern Hebrew means, anybody know? Genius, right. That's not what it used to mean. What it meant was a person with power. If you know the Yiddish expression, Bal Gaiva, anybody ever hear that?
No.
Okay, it's from Hebrew. Bal Gaiva, it means someone who's arrogant. Gaiva means power. Gaon was a person who possessed power because the head of the yeshiva was the person everybody addressed all their questions about Jewish practice to. Many of the early letters that are found in the Cairo Geniza in Egypt are letters that have been written to the Gaon, or letters, responses written by the Gaon. So from all over the Jewish world, people would send away letters to these leaders of the yeshivot in Babylon. The earliest sidurim that we have were written by the Gaonim in response to communities that sent them letters asking them for guidance, what prayers are we supposed to say? So they wrote out a sidur and they sent it. They were very important, the Gaonim. Well, when you get to the year 921 of the Common Era, 10th century, you get a major conflict because there was a fellow by the name of Aharon ben Meir who was the head of the yeshiva in Israel. And he argued that the way we were setting the calendar, which was set by the Gaonim in Babylon, was wrong. Said there's a mistake in the way you're doing it. And I don't want to bog us down in the technicalities of the calculation, although it's fascinating stuff. But he said, your calculation system is incorrect. And he said, not only is your calculation system incorrect, but if you look in the Talmud, you will find that the calendar is always supposed to be set in the land of Israel. You only set the calendar with an authority outside of Israel if there is no one in Israel. But there is. I'm here. I have an academy. I have a yeshiva. So you guys in Babylon have to stop. The Jews who are living in Babylon have their system. And everybody in the Jewish world has been following them. Up steps a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Sadia. Sadia ben Yosef al-Fayumi, who would become Rabbi Sadia Gaon, but he was not a Gaon yet. But at this point, he says, no, your system is wrong. And Israel does not have primacy on this score. Maybe back in the old days, with the old system of the calendar and the witnesses, and maybe in the old days, yes, but it's not sacrosanct. We can set the calendar in Babylon. And this fellow, Aaron ben Meir in Israel, says, you have the wrong day for Pesach. No, but this is not why there are 2 days. 2 days came was long before him. This would have made like 4 days. The 16 cups of wine. He says, you've got the wrong day for Passover. Next Rosh Hashanah is going to be the wrong. Yom Kippur is going to be the wrong day. Can you imagine the split in the Jewish world? Right? I mean, this is one thing, thank God, we have not split on. Is that we all observe the same day as Rosh Hashanah, the same day as Yom Kippur, the same day as Passover, but that would have ended in the year 922 of the Common Era. This fellow, Aharon ben Meir, says, you guys are doing it wrong. He sends messages to his followers saying, you have to observe on this day. And Rabbi Sadia, not yet Gaon, sends messages out saying, no, he's wrong, absolutely not, and the center of scholarship is supposed to be Babylon. And Rabbi Sadia won. And we all ended up observing this one day. Aaron ben Meir lost. But that was part of this battle of, are you legitimately Jewish if you're not in the land? Is it really all about Israel and not about the Jews who are living in exile? You had this very fraught relationship and rivalry regarding this definition of Jewish. But it doesn't stop there. It continues in modern times. And this takes us back to some of the discussions we had when we started this conversation. There are some who have returned to Israel who claim that theirs is the true center of Jewish life. Yeah, I brought you a quote here on the sheet, in source number 10. This is my translation from the website of the Chief Rabbinate of Israel. Now, this is not about conversion, and this is not about reform and conservative and orthodox, and that's none of that, because that's its own discussion. But look at what they say on their website. The chief rabbinate serves the exile, not only as a spiritual authority for legal questions, but also as an information resource for all Jewish communities and all organizations providing kosher supervision around the world. They envision themselves as the authority for communities around. You have some question in your synagogue that needs an answer? Write away to the chief rabbinate of Israel, and they are going to be the ones to give you an answer. That's their belief. I brought you already. We already read it. Number 11. This fellow, Rabbi Gimpel. And, he, by the way, he grew up in Atlanta. His family made Aliyah when he was a kid. But his argument that to be a Zionist when you have the option of being in the land means you have to go there. He doesn't accept it as Zionist unless you actually move. Take a look at number 12. Number 12 is Orthodoxy specific, but I think you can make the translation to Jews as a whole, written by a fellow by the name of Michael Eisenberg. He was a couple of years ahead of me in Yeshiva University in New York, and then he made Aliyah. And this article just was last month in Tablet. You may have seen it.
Yeah.
American Orthodoxy is suffering from a lack of ideas and ideals that are the direct result of a lack of leadership. The question is, what happened to those leaders? And he says, I think the answer is inherent in the appointment of Rabbi Dr. Berman. What he's talking about is Yeshiva University, my alma mater, has just appointed its new president, and they appointed Rabbi Berman. Rabbi Ari Berman was a year ahead of me in school, but he was a successful rabbi in a synagogue in Manhattan, and then he made Aliyah. He left it. He made Aliyah, went to work, got a PhD, and he was called back, so to speak, to serve as the new president of the university. So Michael Eisenberg is saying the fact that you had to go to Israel to find a president, you couldn't find anybody in the diaspora, signals the problem. Like Rabbi Berman, they, the future leaders, moved to Israel. Moreover, I would argue the ideas and ideals that animate American Orthodoxy and will necessarily impel it forward in the 21st century have also moved to Israel. So this is sort of a triumphalist argument. Israel has won. Israel is the center, and that's where the Jew is a Jew. To which, once again, there's a backlash. Here's a funny thing. Source number 13. Rabbi Reuven Spolter, when he wrote this article, was the rabbi of a synagogue in Oak Park, Michigan, suburb of Detroit. And also a classmate of mine. This is apparently just old home day here for the sources.
It's a good class.
So he wrote an article, as you see here, in 2004 called In Search of Leaders, bemoaning what he thought of as a brain drain in which young Orthodox families are leaving North America and moving to Israel. And he talks about a particular family, the Blooms, who made Aliyah from his community. And he says, while I congratulated the Bloom family for making Aliyah and encouraged my members to seriously consider following their lead, I saw their move as an ominous sign for the American modern Orthodox community. The reason I call this funny is because about 5 years ago, he made Aliyah. I guess if you can't beat him, join him. He's now the spokesman for Tzohar, if you're familiar with the Tzohar organization in Israel. So he's one of their spokesmen. But there's a definite backlash. There's a website called lookingatzion.com, which collects statements by Jews who do not live in Israel, who feel like their accomplishments and their Judaism is not necessarily appreciated and understood in Israel. If you take a look at source number 14, this is Ben Swartz, who's the national chairman of the South African Zionist Federation. He was asked, in your opinion, what is the main thing Israelis fail to understand about the reality of being Jewish outside of Israel? To which his answer is, one, Israel is as responsible to the diaspora as the diaspora should be to Israel. And number two, often the views of Israel are crystallized around world Israel and world America, and the relevance of other communities of the world, Canada, South Africa, whatever, are marginalized. This is a big error. That's his response. It's a very Jewish thing. They asked him, what is the main thing? So he has to give two main things as his answer. But you see here this controversy I didn't even get into. Yeah.
Apropos this.
Yeah.
I once attended an Israeli film that was shown at the university. And there were a lot of non-Jewish professors and other educating, you know, people at this event. And it was highly critical of Jews in Israel. And the director was there to speak and so on. And, you know, when he got up, you can imagine what the questions were. I stayed behind. I was fuming. And I went up to him, the director, and I said, you really have your nerve. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to put a film like this on, bring it to diaspora, and just give people food to criticize Israel even more. So this is what this reminded me of.
Yeah.
I said, where is your responsibility? You go home, and we're left with the anti-Semitism rising even more than, you know, that's already there. I'll never forget that.
What did he say?
He was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But he certainly didn't apologize or explain.
Yeah. It's true. There is a lack of comprehension of what it's like when you're in diaspora, exile, whatever you want to call it. And it occurs on many levels. I don't usually think about it in terms of what you're talking about. I usually think about it in certain other ways, but I think you're right. And all of this doesn't even begin to get into a whole other phenomenon, which we really should discuss, but it would take us, you know, another hour. And that's the Yoreid phenomenon. What about Jews who are from Israel who choose to leave?
Yeah.
Right? So what is this? You know, you talk about Jews who are living in Israel and them as, you know, them claiming potentially we have the true Jewish identity because we're in the land and we're with our history and we're the ones who are sacrificing for the state and all that. And we're the ones who have the religious fulfillment. And you have the ones who are outside who, you know, who say, well, there's legitimacy to what we are also and we are supporting, and I'm going to actually add to that. You know, what about Jews who say, you know, we grew up here, but enough, and now we want to live somewhere else? There's a very large population of Yoredim in Toronto. You know, what would they say to this? So I think that's another facet of this question. But one last element for modern times is the financial issue. Right. What was the chalukah? What does the term chalukah refer to? Are you familiar with the word?
No.
Portion,
right? Chalukah is distribution. Chalukah was the term for what started in Europe once you had, I'm not sure exactly when it started, I shouldn't say, but it started a couple of centuries ago in Europe. The practice of collecting funds to send to Israel to support Jewish life there. That was called the chalukah, and it continues obviously with community funding today. Yeah, and that's something that has led to some element of controversy as well in terms of the degree to which Jews outside of Israel are responsible to fund what is in Israel, to the degree to which they want to accept the funding support of Jews outside of Israel. I referenced here in number 15, just I couldn't resist, the Salah Shabbati movie. You're familiar with this? It's an Israeli film about, I think he's Moroccan or Yemenite immigrant. He's kind of a shlemiel. I don't know how that translates for his Spartan, but he's kind of a shlemiel. He sort of, you know, bounces around trying to find his way. And at one point he gets a job working for an organization that, you know, like Karen Kayemet, that brings in money to plant trees. And so there's a classic scene, that's the one. There's this classic scene in which, as every tour group comes in, his job is to change the sign on the forest to reflect that group. But that's what we're, there is this this tension. And on the Israeli side, not everybody wants that support. Not everybody is so accepting. I brought you in source number 16, this article from 1995 from the Washington Post. American aid to Israel is in dispute now as never before. In part, this has to do with the perception that Israel's security needs have diminished, and in part from budget pressures in Congress. But there's another dynamic at work. A growing number of Israelis themselves are saying that perpetual U.S. government financial aid to Israel may not be a good thing. In January 1994, Labor Party Knesset member Yossi Beilin told the Women's International Zionist Organization that Israel may no longer need diaspora Jewry's contributions. If our economic situation is better than in many of your countries, how can we go on asking for your charity? Now, the dynamics of foreign aid are fascinating in their own right. But the point is that this added another layer to the question of Jewish identity, because you have people who are sending support from overseas who say, how can you question my Zionism and how can you question my Jewish identity when I take the money that I could have spent on my community, and instead I'm sending it there. And you find Jews on the other hand, on the other side, who are saying, actually, we'd be happier if we were independent. We don't want to turn to people outside. So having now gone through this, right, having now seen a little bit of why the idea exists of saying that actually, if you're living in the state, or when there is no state, if you're trying to live in the state, that's what makes you a true Jew, going all the way back to these tribes who decided they wanted to live east of the Jordan, moving ahead to the period of the Second Temple and the Jews who did not come back to build the Second Temple, moving ahead to the period of the Talmud, and these statements about living outside of the land, being more distant from God, and then seeing the backlash from those who are outside saying, well, maybe your settlement in Israel isn't really all it's cracked up to be, and your scholarship in the land isn't all it's cracked up to be, and you don't get to set the calendar, we get to set the calendar. You have this back and forth and the strength that's involved. The question is, so what do we do? How do we answer this question? What do we do with this? And to me, that's really what we need to solve. The rivalry is unproductive. Debating, I'm more of a Jew than you are because I live in the land, or I'm more of a Jew than you are because I support living in the land, isn't going to help anyone. And we don't want to be defined out, and we don't want to define others out. So what is it that we do? How do you solve this problem? So here I go back to the original story. Those tribes that decided they wanted to live outside of the land. Take a look at your sheet, please, at source number 17. Joshua chapter 22. This is towards the end of the book of Joshua. After they've fought for the land, and after they've divided the land up among the tribes, you're now 14 years into, or now 15 years into, Jewish life in the land. It's time for all those soldiers who had come to help them fight for the land to return home. Right? Now they have to go back and go to their families. And look at what they did. Source number 17. And they, these tribes, came to Gililot of the Jordan in the land of Canaan. The term Gililot doesn't lend itself to easy translation there, so I just left it. They came to Gililot of the Jordan, by the Jordan River, in the land of Canaan. And the tribes of Reuben and Gad and half of Manasseh, because half of the tribe of Manasseh was also assigned to live east of the Jordan, not by their request, but by national request, for reasons that are beyond the scope of what we're doing right now, but half of the tribe of Manasseh as well, built an altar there by the Jordan, a great altar for show. Now, that's a problem. Why is that a problem? It's for them to build this great altar? Well, it looks like it's idolatrous.
Yeah.
Right? We have a central altar. It's the tabernacle, the Mishkan. It's in a place called Shiloh. And that's where Jews are supposed to bring their offerings. What in the world are they doing building this great big altar? Well, word gets back to everybody else. And the children of Israel heard, saying, behold, the tribes of Reuben and Gad and half of Manasseh have built an altar beside the land of Canaan on the side of the Jews. Meaning the side of Israel before you cross. And the children of Israel heard, and the entire nation of the children of Israel gathered to Shiloh to ascend upon them in force. There's going to be a war. That's what it looks like is about to happen. But that didn't happen. They send a delegation led by a gentleman by the name of Pinchas, who you may be familiar with. And Pinchas goes to them with his diplomats. The same Pinchas, the one who's known as such a zealot in the wilderness, is the peacemaker here. He goes with a diplomatic group, and he says, what in the world do you think you're doing? And they said to him, what we did was for show, for a particular reason. Take a look at number 18. This is from their response. It is a sign between us and you,
and between our generations after us, to perform the service of God before him with our burnt offerings, sacrifices, and peace offerings. And your children shall not say to our children, to our children tomorrow, you have no portion in God. In other words, this really is just for show. We're not bringing offerings there. This is a statement that your tabernacle in Shiloh is ours also. So we built a model of the altar on the spot where we crossed the Jordan. And now it makes sense. It says they built a large altar for show, and they put it on the other side. It wasn't on their side of the Jordan. It was on the other side of the Jordan, right? The mainstream side. They said, we just did it because we wanted to make sure that future generations of Israelis wouldn't say that the Jews who live outside the land aren't real Jews. We wanted to avoid getting drummed out. That's what they wanted to avoid. At that point, everybody kisses and hugs and they're all happy. But the point is that making the statement of, we are of you, building this altar as they did, making the statement, we are part of the nation. And go back to what they did initially, when they said, we want to live on the eastern side of the Jordan, but we're going to fight for the land. We're going to invest with you. They even end up fighting ahead of them. So strengthening those bonds are the way to combat this delegitimization of, you're not in the land, you're not Israeli, therefore you're not Jewish. You need these visible symbols and the investment along with them in order to create that connection. And I think the same thing is true today. You know, Jews outside of Israel may not, by and large, pay taxes in Israel and fight in the IDF. But as was mentioned, there still is the possibility of support. Religious life here is not the same as religious life in Israel. No matter how observant somebody is, there are laws that are only bound in Israel. But that doesn't mean you don't have meaningful religious life outside of the land. And most of all, being outside of the land does not necessarily mean that we are a separate nation. With ties of investment, financial, personal, family, we do demonstrate, and with visible symbols we demonstrate, that the tribes of Reuven, Gad, and Manasseh were right. That we still, despite being outside of the land, can yet remain one people and united. Yes.
Mm-hmm.